This is CliffCentral.com. Perfect night.
Yeah, dun 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 dun. There's a little Ed Sheeran for you. You know, for those people who are feeling romantic this time of year, because there is Valentine's Day next month, and we thought we'd just get you on the right track.
It's our less than a month.
Yes, that's true. And what a dumb time to have a day where you have to buy your partner presents.
Why?
Because no one has money.
Middle of the second month of the year, you're having a laugh.
No one has cash. Who you got lying around? Flowers. You know, if you want to give someone flowers for Valentine's, they can pick them from your garden. It's the only way they're going to get them.
But you know, Valentine's Day becomes an absolute, like, commercial disaster when they're offering you early bird deals. If you send it on the 13th, you can get it, like, cheaper.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, then you send them on the 13th, and you get them, and you put them in water. Give them to her on the 14th. Hey, we got to save money.
This is true.
Justice will be in a moment or two for the burning platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. But before we get to that, Mubs has got her eye on some news.
Yes, Gareth. Well, a total of 117 full ownership title deeds were handed over to people in the Stellenbosch Town Hall earlier this week.
Wonderful.
For council properties for which they were paying rent. The handover is a result of work by the Free Market Foundation's Kaya Lam initiative and businessman Johan Rupert. So title deeds were given by the executive mayor of Stellenbosch municipality, Jesse van der Venter, to tenants of council properties. The beneficiaries for the deeds are from Kylemore, Leroux, Klootsville, Franschhoek, and the oldest beneficiary is 87 years old. And these are the first of 1,000 titles that they're going to be sponsoring to help bring about true transformation, according to the Free Market Foundation.
Well, we've talked about this so many times, that if you've been living in a certain house, maybe even for generations, and you've been paying your taxes, that house, if it's not already, if you don't have a title deed to it and no one else has a title deed to it, why the hell not?
Yeah. Van der Venter also added, worldwide, there is a trend that shows a clear relationship between property ownership or the lack thereof and levels of poverty. In countries where people own their property, it results in greater security and prosperity, and then it lowers levels of poverty as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because then you have, if you have a house and you have a title deed, guess what? You have something to borrow against if you need to start a business or you need some fast cash. If you don't have that property, you don't have a foot into the economy. You've got to sit outside the economy watching other people participate, especially if you're unemployed. So this immediately makes how many households?
Well, there were 117 title deeds that were given out this week. This is the first of 1,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we'll eventually get 1,000 people in South Africa who didn't own property. Just by a piece of paper, those 1,000 people will become property owners. Do you know what a difference that makes?
Well, in the words of Donald Trump, huge.
Yes.
Now you know how this can happen elsewhere if people actually wanted it to.
Yeah.
Yeah. So between 5 and 7 million black and colored families still live as tenants or without ownership rights in houses that they have lived in for generations. Gareth, you mentioned the generation thing. So I suppose the Free Market Foundation are, in, you know, in their small way, in the way that they're able to, they are starting the process of trying to rectify that.
Good.
So
at least someone, because it's not the political parties, at least someone and some people who give a shit about, you know, the poor are making an effort.
It's definitely not any of the political parties.
No. And this is the point, right? It's like the political parties could have done this. They could do this. I know Herman Mashaba's talking about doing it in Joburg. I don't know if he's done a lot already. I'm not sure what's happened there. But this is what happens when the Free Market Foundation, I know Leon Lowe has been on about this for ages. You can listen to that interview if you go to cliffcentral.com. You type in Leon Lowe. You'll hear he said this a year or two ago.
Mm.
And now it's starting to happen. Imagine you've lived in a house, small little property, whatever you've got, for years, you've had no title deed, so you don't own it. So the bank says, your balance is zero. You have no money. Then you go to the bank today, because now you got your title deed. You say to the bank, oh, look at this. I own a property worth 100,000 rand, maybe more. Suddenly you have a positive ability to borrow money against that property. That makes you 100,000 rand in real terms richer than you've ever been. Means you've got something to lose. Means you've got something to look after, something you can call yours. Now that is economic freedom. It's the beginning of you being a part of the real economy. It's terrific. This is something we should make much more of a fuss about and celebrate.
Absolutely.
All right.
And then a man in Connecticut has been sent to prison.
For?
Well, he bit off his wife's nose.
Jesus, what is up with these? What? What?
He bit off a chunk of his wife's nose.
No.
Permanently disfiguring her. And he has been sent to prison for more than 6 years.
Mm. No.
The Hartford court reports that the 55-year-old man, Rodwell Clay, was sentenced after pleading under the Alford Doctrine to a first-degree assault charge, which basically means that while he does not agree with all the state's allegations, he acknowledges there is enough evidence to convict. And so 6 years for you, Rodwell, for biting off your wife's nose.
How do you do that? Jesus. And how much force do you have between your jaws to... Ugh.
The couple has since divorced, you think? And the woman says that she wants nothing to do with Rodwell, who she says stalked, harassed, and threatened her during their marriage.
Have you ever been that angry? Oh, I'm so angry at you. I want to bite your nose off.
I've never been that cross with anyone.
Well, guys, it all starts from those parents who said to little babies, I've got your nose. And obviously it happened to this guy so many times. In adult life, he eventually bit someone else's nose off.
Is that the case?
Don't ever play that game with us, with kids. It's okay. Mean.
But I mean, isn't there some cartilage in your nose? Like, how hard do you have to...
Have you ever... you know the chicken breast? It's got that piece of cartilage in the middle.
Yes.
That's what it would be like to... Have you ever bitten through that?
Yes.
Yeah, it's grisly and nasty. So that's what it would be like to bite into someone's nose. Yuck. And bit it off. This guy bit it off.
Yep, he took a chunk, bit it off, and now this poor woman has been disfigured as well. So, and how do you, because obviously now, from now on, everywhere she goes, people are going to be staring at her face. If somebody has the audacity to ask her, what does she say?
Talk about an icebreaker.
Well, Jesus. My ex-husband bit off my nose.
Hey, ma'am, what happened to your face? Oh, it's just, you know, it's a bite. What, your dog? No, my ex-husband. All right. Because she can't speak properly after that. Going to be major reconstructive surgery.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting message or two. We work at a government hospital in Mpumalanga, and a lady bit off her husband's nose because he cheated on her. We still see him often.
Whoa.
So this is happening here. It's not just in Connecticut. And good morning. I couldn't listen to the Peter Hain discussion yesterday. I'm looking for the podcast. Any reason it's not on, thank you, Jean in Durban. Jean, I'll check that out, but it should be on the list. If you just type in Peter Hain, you'll find it on cliffcentral.com. And Michelle says, interesting you guys are talking about pet insurance. My cat went flying out of the fourth floor window twice. I know that we paid for our vet's house overseas. Oh, pet insurance is the way to go, Michelle. And then someone says, this is in Dipiwe. Dipiwe says, I'm busy reading the Gulag Archipelago. The book is changing me. I don't trust any human being anymore. We're all capable of such atrocities. Well, that's an incredible book. It's by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. It's about the Soviet forced labor camp system. And if there's anybody who thinks that anything that happened in Russia, and particularly Stalinist Russia in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, well, 40s, 50s, 60s, really, if they think that there's, you know, it's a good story to tell, you've got to go and read Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And any of his books, I would suggest, would be an interesting place for you to study what can happen under vicious dictatorships. We know a lot more about the dictatorships of the right because many people fought against Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini, but we don't often spend as much time looking at the the dictatorships on the left, and perhaps it's worth taking a look at the Gulag Archipelago. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, like Ndipuwe did. All right, it's time for us to get stuck into the year. And a lot of people have been waiting for this. In fact, I got emails and messages all day yesterday and the day before. People saying, when is Justice in? Well, you know he's in on a Thursday. And here he is this morning to give us the latest in the Burning Platform, which is brought to you in 2018 by Nando's. Da, 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 da. Justice, nice to see you. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Very good.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. Happy New Year indeed. Did you manage to, after the ANC conference, which is the last time we spoke to you, did you get any rest?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I went away. I did a bit of a tour of the Western Cape and the Eastern Cape, and made my way back. So, yeah, it's been good. It's been very relaxing. It's been nice to watch all the politics from afar. As I drove here today, and Sia called me and said, "How far are you?" I thought, jeepers, I won't survive the Cyril Ramaphosa presidency, you know, because stuff starts on time today.
Right, well, that's what Cyril's already doing. I was talking to Mabale about this earlier. So let's talk about Cyril, because we were all very suspicious when this top six were elected, and we still are. I mean, there's a lot that isn't as cut and dried as many people would like it to be.
No, not at all.
But if you were President Zuma now, you would be very nervous. I think looking at people like Richard Nluli being sent on their way, looking at Sean Abrahams, who's about to be sent on his way, you see ministers who were very confident before December, very confident, suddenly very nervous. And it appears that Cyril is on a hell of a ride. He's gone to visit Mamwini. He went to King Goodwillswelatini. He's checking on all the branches. He's going from province to province. He's really making sure that everyone knows he's in charge.
He's been very interesting. I thought that visit to Winnie Mandela was quite something. Winnie Mandela is in many ways underestimated for the influence she has in the ANC, and particularly on branch membership. And I think it was ironic, but also very astute to visit her.
Why ironic, first of all?
Well, ironic because if you go back to the late 80s, early 90s, you remember Winnie Mandela was accused of being involved in the death of Stompisi Bey, who was a young kid. I think he was 13. Who was killed by members of the Mandela Football Club, or some of the members of the Mandela Football Club.
Right.
And interestingly, when the matter became so controversial, so big in the newspapers, it was the one thing. The ANC and the UDF had this fantastic reputation, freedom fighters and so forth. But the blot on its copybook was that, look at what the violence, look at what is happening with the Mandela Football Club. It was Cyril Ramaphosa who, and some leaders of the UDF, Mephi Morube, Terali Kota, I think was among them, who visited Winnie Mandela and came back from that meeting and issued a statement saying the UDF distances itself from these actions and from this team and from her.
Oh, wow.
And it was not an easy thing to do. Think about it. The icon Winnie Mandela, the wife of the icon Nelson Mandela, and you say, no, we are not part of this. This is not in our name. And he did it. And many, many people said, this guy will never survive in the ANC ever again. It's over. It's curtains for him. And yet today he's the president of the ANC. So I thought it was ironic that he went and visited, and that peace has somewhat been made between the two. But also astute, because I think he's slowly building his power basis within the ANC. He's touching the right buttons. If you think about what happened at the conference in December. The KZN ANC, which always said, "Oh, we are so powerful. Oh, we can do this. We can, we have the most members," and so forth. Mm-hmm. Suddenly the KZN ANC doesn't have a single member in the top six.
Yeah.
And that's because they divided themselves. They went against Senzo Mchunu, instead of supporting him so that he walks away from KZN and leaves them to their own devices. They backed the wrong horse in Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. They did everything that they shouldn't have done, and they lost out massively. And so they are not in the top six. So what he was doing there was to say, no, it doesn't mean that you're outside of the ANC, doesn't mean that we don't care about the king, the traditional leaders, and so forth and so forth. Again, you see that strategic Cyril Ramaphosa at work, saying, I'm going to keep everyone in the tent. I'm going to try and make sure that even when or if I pull the trigger on Jacob Zuma, that
nothing falls apart.
That nothing falls apart. That you get rid of the one man, but the house stays intact. So I think all that is a build up to today. I'm not sure if anyone has information here whether starting at 10 or starting at 2, but the National Executive Committee of the ANC starts its meeting today. It will be interesting. As he said on Sunday to one of the interviewers, he gave interviews to all the TV, the 24-hour TV channels. He said, we will start on time.
And, because didn't President Zuma arrive for some event just recently in the Eastern Cape or some? It was the birthday.
Yeah.
And he arrived like 3 hours late or something.
Well, I mean, on Saturday he arrived well into the program. I think he was 21 minutes late. Mm. But, you know, he's very famous for being always late. For me, the worst was 2009, the June 16 celebrations, when he arrived at 3:20 p.m. when he was supposed to speak at 10 a.m. And people had been waiting and waiting and waiting. And that's been the Jacob Zuma presidency has been the basically just him pitching up whenever he wants.
Justice, how does that happen? Because there's oversleeping and then there's arriving 500 million hours late. Is it just a matter of their schedules are always so erratic and so hectic that they...
No, I think what Cyril Ramaphosa said, imagine that you pitch up for a meeting with someone and that person doesn't arrive. They obviously don't take you or the business you're about to discuss seriously. So imagine that.
Well, imagine him rocking up at Saxon World 5 hours late. That wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
No. It depends on which day you're talking about. Oh. This week, I think you can not pitch up at Saxon World because things are happening there and will likely happen.
It's like in that Nando's ad where they're packing the stuff in the car and trying to get the hell out of there, right?
Oh, wow.
Do you think that the net is closing on the state capture crew?
I think the net is definitely closing. I think that what we're seeing is just the tip of the iceberg. So it starts with Trillion. You'll remember it's the Gupta Link company which milked some money out of Eskom. Then it goes to McKinsey. But it will get closer. It will get closer. It will get to start with the Optimum coal mine that was sold and resold and reshuffled and cut up so that it can benefit Duduzani Zuma and the Gupta family. It will get closer and closer, and we'll get to the heart of this thing sooner rather than later. What I'm liking, what I'm really loving is that, you know, for years and years, we've been talking about a commission of inquiry, a judicial commission of inquiry into all this stuff. What we are seeing is actually criminal action. This is what it's. If Mabale steals Sia's phone from the desk here, why should we have a commission of inquiry? We need to go to a police station. A cop needs to come, investigate, arrest, and go to court, and the thief goes to jail. What we've been talking about is irrelevant. So Jacob Zuma last Tuesday issues a statement saying, I'm going to appoint a commission of inquiry as I've been instructed by the ANC. Well, that's great. But a commission of inquiry, we're going to get Judge Zondo. We're going to get all these people coming in. Everyone says something and then we all go away. And then there's a report and we all read it and we say, oh, it's damning. And no one goes to jail. Mm. What we like now is that someone in the NPA, in the asset forfeiture unit, we understand there's 20 people working on this case, are beginning to say, here is a case to be answered. Let's go for it. And that for me is very encouraging. I don't want the Guptas to go and appear in front of a commission of inquiry. I don't care. I want them to answer before a judge and convince the judge that, no, I'm innocent. Or let the state prove that they're guilty.
Sure.
And then that's it. That's it. You either go to jail or you stay.
So outside of the NPA, who else, if anybody, has the power to then step in and say, no, we are going to prosecute you in the event of a commission of inquiry? Because that yields no result.
Well, the commission of inquiry only acts as a basis and then it goes to the criminal authorities. So it will go on. But actually, there are some things where it's a bit like Parliament failing to act on Nganza. And then this matter has to be taken by the EFF and the DA and Musiwaleko Third Cope and others to the courts so that they can force Parliament to do its job.
Right.
So what we're doing, instead of going direct that, no, there's a criminal activity here, let's deal with it, we're going around and say, let's find out about this and so forth. And it's taken us way out. Some of this stuff is so criminal, it doesn't need to be thought about twice. It needs a prosecutor and for this to happen. So who else would be able to act? Well, we need a national prosecuting authority. We need a director of the national prosecuting authority who is independent and who will make the decision. I see you're smiling because you know your friend's name is coming up in a minute. Yes, Sean is the...
My friend, my buddy's good, friend.
My homie, my boy.
Sean the Sheep. Sean Abrahams needs to have acted years ago. He still hasn't acted.
Yeah.
So if you think about the fact that finally Fikile Mbalula acted on Richard Mdluli, for example, on the fact that the asset forfeiture unit is acting despite the Sean Abrahams for years and years not acting at all. I think that within the NPA itself, there are people who are saying, Baba, you can keep on deliberating. We are going ahead with this. And I think that's the sense are shifting in the NPA and in our political firmament generally. And I think we're going to see some action. And I think one of the actions we are going to see, remember that, the Pretoria High Court, Judge Dunstan Mlambo ruled towards the end of last year that Cyril Ramaphosa can and must appoint a head of the NPA. And so Cyril Ramaphosa said last week that no, this is a matter that needs a simple discussion. I think if he hasn't had that discussion, he's going to have it in the next few days. And Sean Abrahams is out of a job. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have someone with real courage, hopefully coming in. And that is when, that ad you're talking about, people packing, you may find that some people, it would be interesting. Where's Sia? Sia needs to do some Googling and some research and find out for us, is there an extradition treaty between South Africa and the United Arab Emirates? Because if someone is living in the UAE, and suddenly the authorities here decide that we're going to want to speak to Atul or to Dudu Zane, can they say, oh, come back from Dubai and ask the authorities there to show them their way to the airport?
Hmm.
That will be key, because then we can have those people here in South Africa being asked some very tough questions about their criminal activities.
Did I see that Musbenzi Zwane is also being charged with something or another, or
yes,
investigating something.
There is talk that he will be charged. You know, the nicest thing about about document and history and so forth is that Musbenzi Zwane has been jumping up and down and doing all sorts of things. But what they're going for, what the authorities, I believe, are going for him for is what happened with that dairy farm way back in 2012, when this dairy farm was handed over to a Gupta-linked company, and that family took 30 million rand, sent it to Dubai, sent it back to South Africa for the wedding for their daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Remember who was the MEC for agriculture who signed over that farm to the Vrede farm in the Free State to the Gupta family? It was Musbenzi Zwane. And you can see the links between him and them throughout the past 8 years or so. And lo and behold, that is where it will start. Then there will be other things, I'm sure. His involvement in the sale of that Optimum coal mine from the big conglomerate to the Guptas. The fact that he flew to Switzerland in their private jet to do the deal, all that will come out as well. So, it's going to be very exciting. I think that we'll have a cabinet reshuffle, whatever happens, because, some people will be on trial and will need real, ministers to, continue with the work, while, Musebenzi Zwane appears in court. So yes, I think that there will be a lot happening on that front.
Justice, there's a lot of other stuff going on that we need to get into, but I'm very confused by what's happening with Patricia de Lille. I don't understand what the DA is up to here. I don't know whether this is internal party horse trading, faction fighting, whatever you want to call it. I don't know what's going on. Can you help explain it to me, please?
I would love to be able to explain it to you, but one of the things about the DA at the moment is that no one can really put a finger on what's happening in that organization. It seems to be imploding. It seems to me that when it has a chance to regroup, think deeply about how to win or how to get better traction in 2019, that it's turning on itself. What's happening in Cape Town seems to be two things. One, some of the issues that are coming out about Patricia de Lille need her to answer some of those questions. For example, the issue of the city manager who she wanted to appoint, to reappoint, the fact that she sent SMSs to people who were interviewing some of the prospective incumbents saying, I want Mabale, so give her the highest point and so forth. That is just incredibly damning. You don't do that. You don't load the system in favor of one person in that way. It seems as if she became very self-regarding, that she believed that she was the life and soul of the DA in Cape Town in particular, that she's responsible for its wins in the last elections and so forth, and that she became a bit of a
no one to herself,
if you will. That would be it. But
she says that this is a witch hunt and that she will defend herself and she's going to sue the people who brought these charges that she says are completely unfair against her.
Yeah, and I hope she does, so that we can get to the heart of the matter. The other side of the story is that there is major infighting in the DA in Cape Town. We saw that with the elections that were held earlier in the year when after she left, there has been constant infighting between various leaders of the DA in the Cape. There seems to be camps emerging around allegedly Helen Zille, Madikizela, the new leader, others grouped against Patricia de Lille and others. It's all very confused. If you look at the DA in the Western Cape, it almost feels like the ANC in the run-up to its elections in December. It feels like two different parties pulling this way and that way. And I think what's happening now is that belatedly, Musi Maimane and his federal executive are going in and trying to bring in some semblance of order. Whether they're doing it correctly, I'm not sure. I think their communication around the issues has been terrible. The fact that you don't understand what's going on, I don't understand what's going on, many people don't understand really what's going on with the DA. The fact that the battles around Patricia de Lille have been allowed to go on for so long, it looks from the outside that one, people need to find someone to blame for the failure to act on the drought or to find ways to mitigate against what's been happening. Two, that it's almost been decided that, you know what, at the heart of these problems is Patricia de Lille, and that she has to go. It's very confused. For me, one of the things that stands out is it looks a bit dangerous to be a woman in the DA. Well, think about it. There is Helen Zille. She is the leader.
Three women right now.
Yeah.
Is that woman from KZN?
Balintuli.
Balintuli. There's Patricia. There's Helen. Helen.
You know, there's others.
You think it's a bit patriarchal?
It may. I don't know. I mean, I think it's worth discussing. But I must say, here's the thing. If you are, imagine that you're running a party.
Mm.
The one province that you run is the Western Cape.
Yeah.
Helen Zille, who is the premier of the Western Cape, is not allowed to take part in DA activities. Remember that she's been suspended after her tweets and so forth. So you have someone who can't take part in the party activities, being the leader of the province that you run. Mm. Then you have the person who runs your one major metro that you, well, actually you're running others now in association with the EFF and others. But the one that you actually win and run is being run by someone that you are charging with misconduct, that you've suspended and reintroduced to party activities and so forth and so forth. And it just looks a mess, the DA in the Western Cape. How they come out of this, will be crucial, because we mustn't forget that the DA has always and has increased from 12% or from 1.7% in 1994 on the basis that, look at us, we run the best, we don't fight, we don't do this, we have a mission and we're going to increase consistently. As of the last election, they were 27.7%, I think. Their aim was to get over 30% nationally and go for maybe 35%. But if these fights continue, I think that the DA in 17 months
slide backwards.
Might slide back or might stay where it is.
And having Cyril in the ANC is not suitable for the EFF or the DA.
It's not great for either of them. On the one side, Musi Maimane and Cyril Ramaphosa look exactly alike, except for the fact that Cyril Ramaphosa seems like he is more experienced and knows a little bit more about what he's talking about. On the EFF side, you've got Cyril Ramaphosa and the ANC saying, oh, you know, we'll give back the land, we'll do it a little bit more responsibly, but we'll expropriate without compensation. Oh, yes, and free education. Oh, yes, and this and that and so forth. Suddenly, it doesn't seem so radical anymore to say the land, because, well, the ANC says it too. So, you know, it's a bit of a whammy for the opposition.
All right, but then you bring up the EFF, which is interesting, because their major arguments up to now for being relevant have been land and nationalization and all of that stuff. And then they've backpedaled and then they've gone forward again, and the ANC have stolen a lot of their territory.
Yeah.
And they've really kind of neutralized them in some ways. So then the EFF does things like, storm H&M and go and burn tires outside an Afrikaans school in Laval.
Yes.
And I wonder if they aren't out of ideas. And maybe that these are, because these are clearly attention seeking activities.
Oh, they're attention seeking. I mean, I thought the EFF one was so transparent. The H&M stores, particularly were so transparent. The EFF has sought to embarrass the ANC on every January 8th statement. Mm. And so they will grab at anything. So their best one. And I think this at, in just political communication terms, the best thing was when Jacob Zuma delivered the January 8th statement in Mbombela 3 years ago. And on that day, at the same time as Jacob Zuma was getting on stage, he was late for that, by the way, as he got on stage, Julius Malema got out of a car in front of the Nkandla homestead.
Yes.
And that whole week, they had been building this house right next door to Nkandla, okay? You'll remember, if you look at those pictures of Nkandla, those sort of aerial pictures, there was always a mud house, a mud hut, really, right in front of Jacob Zuma's house. So over the week, they'd been going and building. And as Jacob Zuma started speaking, they said, here we are in Nkandla. And Julius got out and started walking. And then the ANC guys in the neighborhood started pushing him. The cops came. And you know, the next day on the front page of the Sunday Times, on the front page of the City Press, guess who was on the front page? Julius Malema. It was just beautiful. It was just absolutely gorgeous. So you steal the thunder then, and I can't remember what they did in subsequent years. And then Cyril Ramaphosa comes along and you think, oh dear, he's stealing my thunder. Let me try and do something. And they tried to do it to the H&M stores. But what they didn't expect was the backlash, and the backlash was across the board. It wasn't just, from ANC or as they expected, or, you know, don't tell the oppressed how to protest and so forth. It was ordinary people saying this is not the way to do it. You've got power to change things and to do things differently. And so they lost it. So I think it was a cynical ploy to get attention, and it hasn't worked. So my view about the EFF is really that they're reacting desperately. They're not stopping and saying, okay, you've taken some of these things. And I think some of the arguments they put forward, and Julius Malema said this in Polokwane on Sunday, that actually the ANC, the EFF leads, the ANC follows.
Yeah.
And he's right in that, you know, they put stuff on the agenda and the ANC has to respond, or is forced to respond, because it's been led over the past 10 years by someone who hasn't come up with a single original idea. So now they need to say, okay, these guys have followed on these ideas. We need to follow on. We need to come up with new ones. But what they're doing is almost trampling on the gains that they've made. And I think that's for them. That's the wrong tactic. They could build on what they've achieved in a very different way, but they look desperate for attention now, and I don't think it's going to work.
You know, it's just ringing so true to home when you look across the board of the three biggest political parties and how none of us feature on their list of priorities. The DA are busy fighting. This is regardless of the fact that they've got less than 100 days of guaranteed water left. EFF are pulling stunts. Cyril Ramaphosa is busy playing chess to be like the most popular guy. None of this has anything to do with the citizens of this country.
We've seen a bit of a turnaround in sentiment, though. And this is important, because the sentiment was very, very bad last year.
Yeah.
Particularly this time last year, because the finance minister was under threat. The economy was in free fall. I mean, let's just take a moment to take it all in. The Rand is at the best position it's been in 2 years right now.
Yes.
These will start to have positive effects, but people generally are starting to feel a little optimistic as opposed to pessimistic. You remember the bets we were taking last year?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I have to say, I'm feeling very optimistic at the moment. I'm feeling like, wow, you know, the politics of that Cyril Ramaphosa win was so thin, 179 votes. And I felt, ooh, it's hard, and ooh, I don't know, how can he push this around, turn it around? But I have to say, he used a very interesting word. I don't know if you remember, during the conference itself, after the dispute over who won between Ace Magashule and Senzo Mkhunu for the for the Secretary General position, and I think the difference was 24 votes,
yeah,
and Ace Magashule was ahead. So his supporters were saying, "Let's go to court. We're going to fight this." And there's a clip, a video clip that was distributed to people. And it shows Cyril Ramaphosa standing in front of some of these supporters of his. And he uses a very strange-ish word. And he says, what we've won here is a beachhead. Now, beachhead is a term from World War One, World War Two, in which the enemy force gets to the beach and they establish a base, and from there they can fight. And I thought, this guy is interesting, because what he was saying was, yes, we've lost some of the key positions we wanted, we didn't win as big as we thought we were going to win or we had hoped to win, but our toe is in there, we've got a toehold, we're inside. And we can use that to win from the inside. And I think what is done and what is doing in the ANC now is begin that battle from the inside to use that beachhead, that toehold that is established. And I think Mabale, you know, what you said is interesting. You're right. Cyril Ramaphosa hasn't done anything yet. He hasn't. What has he done? Well, he hasn't really done. No. He's pitched up on time, started on time, said we will start on time.
But our standards are so low for expecting anything from a president right now.
I know. We should expect our president to at least be able to keep time. But you know, we've come from 10 years of terrible things. But one thing for me that I think is happening is that by beginning to say, look, things will change, the sentiment changes, the optimism comes through. The fact that we're seeing something beginning to happen with the NPA, Asset Forfeiture Unit, Mdluli out. And me, these are small, very small steps. But I think what we were hoping for, that politics of principle, politics of this is about the people. It's not about just us, the politicians, are beginning to filter back into the ANC and hopefully into the political firmament in general. So I agree with you that at the moment it doesn't look like it's anything to do with ordinary people. But I think hopefully that sentiment will begin to filter into investments, into markets, yeah, into ordinary people getting up and saying, you know what, tomorrow will be better than today. Because I think under Jacob Zuma, the idea that tomorrow will be better than today was being ground out of the system. In fact, increasingly we were beginning to think, oh dear, look, today this happens, tomorrow, oh God, it's just going to be worse. If you look at things like economic growth, Jacob Zuma took this economy from 6% growth, 5.9% growth to 0.3% growth. So every year was getting worse than the previous year. Hopefully now we can begin to make our way back to growth, to job creation, to employment, or at least begin to talk about those things instead of, ooh, what's wife number four doing now? Or what's, oh, you know, I mean,
or
all
the,
this.
Or the, what are the Guptas doing
now? What are the Guptas doing now? All these distractions that we don't need in our politics. So I think it's a beginning. I agree with those who are feeling optimistic. I'm feeling optimistic. I'm feeling more optimistic than I've felt about our politics. I'm feeling more optimistic than I've felt in a very long time.
I just want to, while we're talking about the Guptas, and then I do want to know what you think will happen to President Zuma and when you think it will happen. But here, this is someone, Nicholas, just said, I've just tuned in, not sure if you've discussed this, but how coincidental that now the assets forfeiture unit has decided to take action. Trillion has emptied its office. Have you heard about this?
Yes, they have. Reporters rushed to their offices yesterday and over the past 24 hours, hoping to see the asset forfeiture unit arrive and take over some of this stuff. But, you know, asset forfeiture in the case of monies like this is actually freezing the banks and the bank accounts rather than taking the furniture, because, you know, if you're going after 1.6 billion rand.
That's a lot of furniture.
So you'll need a lot of furniture to do that. But that said, I think one of the things that needs to happen is to watch what sorts of monies have flowed out of this country to places like Switzerland, Dubai, and so forth. Because, McKinsey is saying that they will give back the money that they were paid by Eskom. We have heard nothing about the half a billion rand, 500 million rand that Trillion was paid. And let's not play around here. What Trillion did was that, the Guptas were essentially, part of Trillion. Salim Essa, the head of Trillion, would tell Eskom that, we are the partner for this job and you pay us. And they just got paid half a billion rand, just like that. And it just went and got washed all over the world via the Gupta network. So I'm hoping for some sort of explanation from the asset forfeiture unit that they have frozen those bank accounts. You know, for me, one of the things about these bank accounts is that we have a financial intelligence center in South Africa. That FIC has known about those bank accounts for the past 3 years. One of the cleverest people in National Treasury, the head of the FIC, I can't remember his name off the top of my head right now. Mm-hmm. But those accounts were flagged that, look, 100 million flying out in, a billion flying out in, those who are,
yeah, these people know what we're doing with our money as well. So if a big amount suddenly arrives, people know about it.
Exactly. So those accounts have been flagged for the past 3 years, and I hope that we can follow the money and get it back. For people who think that money won't be found, it's worth thinking about the children of dictators all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Money is found and money is taken back to jurisdiction. Sometimes it takes 10 years, but it is found. And I hope that we can act with haste to at least freeze those millions in our
So,
hands.
Justice, what's going to happen to the principal in all of this state capture nonsense? I mean, there's one man at the center of it who has presided over all of it, and he's still the president of the country, and now that things have changed in the ANC, his power is slipping away. What are the likely outcomes?
You know, guys, we've talked about so much on this show.
You want to just move on?
We've talked about so much on this show in the past 2 years. You think about it, when we spoke about Fakey Mentor being transported from Cape Town to Joburg, picked up and put taken to the Gupta family home and being offered a job as public enterprises minister. And in the room next door was Jacob Zuma. When she said no, he came out and said, "Ah, well, I'm sorry that you don't want to work with us in Ntombazana."
Yeah.
We've seen this play so many times. There are so many people who've told us about what happened in that house with Jacob Zuma and others. Jacob Zuma must go, should go now. But what will happen? Cyril Ramaphosa says Jacob Zuma shouldn't be humiliated. Cyril Ramaphosa doesn't have as much power as he would have hoped for. Remember that when Jacob Zuma got rid of Thabo Mbeki, Jacob Zuma had 60% support in the NEC. Cyril Ramaphosa has about 53% support in this NEC. Some people are already jumping ship. If you listen to Fikile Mbalula, the police minister, he says, oh man, Cyril Ramaphosa is fantastic for the fight against corruption. You can see what's happening there. There's a social media meme doing the rounds about some others, apparently people like Mamoloko Kubai, others are, you know, becoming Cyril Ramaphosa people. We don't know if that's true or not, but you know, there are people who realize that, which side of my bread is buttered, and they're saying, I'm young, and the next 5 years, Cyril Ramaphosa will be in charge, and maybe the next 10 years he'll be in charge.
So people start to turn.
Exactly. How quickly is that turning? I don't think Cyril Ramaphosa will act against Jacob Zuma until he's absolutely sure that when the motion comes before that NEC, he can say, well, we seem to have sufficient consensus. Because I'm telling you now, Batabile Dlamini will say, no. Let's not do that in that NEC. I think Colin Maine will be the first to jump, if he hasn't jumped yet, to the other side. And Kevin Mapatswe will say, no, Jacob Zuma must stay. But he'll be looking at Cyril saying, but if he goes, I'm still with you.
Right.
So I think I'm not convinced that Jacob Zuma will leave this weekend, at this NEC meeting when it concludes on Sunday. I think Jacob Zuma might surprise us on February 8th when he delivers the State of the Nation speech.
You think he will?
I think that he will deliver the State of the Nation speech. I think that is what Cyril Ramaphosa means when he says, let's not humiliate the president. That will be his last big hurrah. He will say the ANC went to its conference, it's chosen new leaders, and because I am such a good man,
I'm going to clear out
to allow the new leadership to take over and continue. And so, out of the goodness of my own heart, I, Jacob Zuma, would like to say bye-bye, sayonara, see you later in court.
Because he's not going to be able to get away from that.
No, he won't be able to get away
from that. So there'll be lots of wailing and hollering from the benches of the opposition. Oh, he's trying to get out easily. He's trying to make it a smooth exit. But in the end, he will have to account for things
as well. Look, Cyril Ramaphosa will need him to be convicted so that he can pardon him. You can't pardon someone who, you can't just turn up and say, hi, Sia, you're pardoned, when Sia has a little, I haven't done anything. Why are you pardoning me? So, you know, there's a problem here. He will need to go to jail first, or to be convicted at the very least, before Cyril can say, out of the goodness of my heart, I'm now pardoning you. So he will see his day in court. He's always been begging for his day in court. He said many times that, but why don't you take me to court instead of impugning my integrity in the public space? So I think he'll get his day in court. But I don't think Jacob Zuma will leave this weekend. I think that on Monday he will go into the cabinet Lekgotla with his colleagues. On January 31, the cabinet Lekgotla will sit. And he'll remain president. I think State of the Nation this year might be full of some surprises. And I think that's the day Jacob Zuma has sort of chosen. I also didn't quite believe the stories that were coming out, particularly by the Mail and Guardian, and I have to take my hat off to them. People like Matuma Letswalo, who's the political editor there. I didn't believe their story. I didn't quite believe their story when they said he's making demands. And one of those demands is that Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma should be the interim president if he steps down. But those stories seem to be increasingly true, that he's digging in and saying, I am ready to go, but these are my demands. But I think that as the Mbalulas and others turn their backs on him, he will realize that he needs to
stop clear bargaining. Out. Get out. Yeah. Yeah. Get out while you're ahead.
Otherwise, he'll find it harder and harder in that NEC. So I think he's going, but I don't think he's going this month. But things are moving swiftly. But Cyril Ramaphosa is going to Davos. He'll be in Davos next week. So I don't think all this stuff will happen in his absence. So my timing is February 8th, or between that and Malusi Gigaba, or a new president, a new finance minister delivering the speech on February
21. With about 3 days run-up.
Yeah.
Well, here are the sounds of what will happen. Thank you, Justice. That's The Burning Platform on cliffcentral.com. It's brought to you every week by Nando's. Interesting political analysis, a filtered view of the world so that you can get there with all the salient facts when everybody at the office wants to talk about this stuff. And no doubt one of South Africa's most formidable people when it comes to figuring out what's going on in politics. Justice Malala, host of so many shows. I saw your Justice Factor the other day.
Oh, yes.
And there are a couple of repeats playing over the holidays.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there's some very interesting guests. You've had you've had them all there. The good, the bad, and the ugly.
I won't talk about this anymore. Okay.
All right, here's what it'll sound like, according to Justice, when the State of the Nation ends on February the 8th. Sayonara! Here's what you need to know this morning. All the important info. Speculation is rife that Kim and Kanye's surrogate for their third child was Kylie Jenner. Unable to have a third child by herself, Kim went with a surrogate route and naturally wanted someone they could trust. Caitlyn apparently offered straight away, but Kim thought Kylie was naturally a better fit. Shamed Marcus Juste is starting to sell some of his properties, starting with a plot at an expensive polo estate in the Cape. He says it's a great buy and will easily attract gold-digging Macy's from the region who aren't stalking rugby players like they used to. Juste promises a mini black book with the property, so if you're in the market for a second home and a bit of a pump, this deal is for you. And finally, Dwayne Vermeulen is going to play for the Stormers in an effort to cement his spot in the Springbok team for the 2019 World Cup. Excited to be returning home after a stint in France, Marcus Juste is apparently already sending him options on a new home in the Cape. Vermeulen has declined them, though, saying he's happily married. Thank you. Coming up, a discussion with the very, very funny Nick Rabinowitz, Gilly Apter, who both popped in to talk to us yesterday. So fresh out of the oven. That's coming up next.
This is CliffCentral.com.